thus a group of students from Iowa Grant High School. Would the students please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. As you know, you're here with the Poet with Class program, which is a program that's sponsored by the Supreme Court and by the State Bar of Wisconsin. It is a national award-winning program and has brought literally thousands of students from around the state to this courtroom. And we hope you will enjoy this session and learn from it. And at noon, you will be joined by Boscobel High School students for a session with Justice Babbage about the processes of the Supreme Court. Now we've met you, I'd like to introduce the court to you all. I'm going to start on my far right with Justice David Prosser. And seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice John Wilcox. To his left, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. We'll proceed with the case in a moment. You are in a renovated and restored courtroom. The restoration has just been completed, and what we're doing along with sitting in a magnificent courtroom is testing out new equipment to amplify our voices to you and the attorney's voices to us. So I'm going to request that all of the justices, including myself, from myself down to Justice Sykes, speak into the microphone and speak slowly so our colleagues to the right of me can hear all our valuable comments, our very valuable comments and questions. So we'll do that, and if we can't be heard, there'll be a signal by the people on the far right indicating they can't be heard. Maybe the signal should be at the microphone twice, because we're never sure when there's a just twice, Justice Bradley.
This is a test, and this has been a real
test. Okay. So if you hear that double tap, it's a signal to the rest of us that we're not doing the right thing with the microphone. So with all of that as a prelude, I'll call our second case. 99-2587-CR, State v. Samuel, and Assistant Attorney General Laura Herman will present the case for the state. Ms. Herman.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Laura Herman, representing the state of Wisconsin. In this case, the defendant, Mr. Samuel, claims that his due process rights were violated when the state used at trial an allegedly coerced statement from a witness. The state's core contention is that a defendant's due process right to a fair trial does not require suppression of an allegedly coerced statement of a witness unless the statement is the product of extreme coercion or torture. And this is true for three primary reasons. First, when a defendant seeks suppression of a witness's statement on due process grounds, the defendant's Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination is not implicated. Second, due process, which is aimed at fundamental fairness, requires a higher threshold for suppression of witnesses' statements because the circumstances surrounding the giving of the statement can be put before the jury to allow the jury to assess the reliability of the statement. And third, not all coercion is unlawful, and not all coercion leads to unreliable statements. Now, a question that has arisen in this case is, what does the state mean by extreme coercion or torture? And state thinks torture, the torture part of that test is pretty self-explanatory. Physical abuse.
This is the usual Wednesday, push Wednesday, testing of the equipment. We're checking to see if my comments are accurate. You may proceed.
Okay. I believe where I left off was saying, the state has proposed the test of extreme coercion or torture before the statement of a witness should be suppressed on due process grounds. And torture, I think, is pretty self-explanatory in the sense of physical abuse or beating someone. But when it comes to extreme coercion, the state has developed a test to help further explain what it means by extreme coercion. And hopefully the court and Mr. Hennick all have a copy of the flowchart that I developed called the extreme coercion test. And I just want to go through that a little bit to explain what the state means when it talks about extreme coercion. Because we are in a due process context when a defendant seeks suppression of a witness's statement and the defendant's Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination is not involved, the state has developed this test that I think gets at the underlying fundamental principles of due process. And the first part of the test requires the defendant to show that there was conduct by the police that shocks the conscience. And if that question is answered yes, then you move on to the second question. Did the statement lack any indicia of reliability? And if both of those questions can be answered yes, then the statement should be suppressed. However, if we get to go back to the first question, was there conduct by the police that shocks the conscience? If there was no shocking police conduct, then the statement ought to be allowed to come in. It should not be suppressed because we are in a due process context, and due process deals with conduct that shocks the conscience. Some of the factors that would go...
Ms. Terman, I don't know why we should have a different test for a defendant coerced statement and a witness's coerced statement. Tell me that.
Sure.
We agree that short of torture, we might not admit a defendant's statement, right? It doesn't have to be torture.
For a defendant's statement, it doesn't have to be torture for it to be suppressed.
And one reason you suppress statements is because when they're given under severe, when they're given under coercion or torture, they're not trustworthy. You can't believe them, right?
That's one of the concerns, yes. And the CLAPS test, which is the test that courts use when a defendant is seeking suppression of his own confession, coerced confession, and CLAPS exists because of the combination of the 14th Amendment due process rights and the Fifth Amendment concerns of self-incrimination. And it's because of the defendant's Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, the defendant cannot be compelled to testify to let the jury hear the circumstances surrounding the statement without also giving up his absolute right not to testify. And so suppression is necessary when we're dealing with a defendant's coerced statement because there's no other adequate remedy to really protect the defendant's Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination.
But if the real point is it's not trustworthy because people will confess if they're tortured, right? I would probably confess to anything. You didn't have to torture me very long. So why would that be admitted into court if you can't trust it? I mean, that's the basic problem, let alone the Fifth Amendment. That's just legalese. Let's just talk about the real point, right?
I'm sorry?
Let's talk about the real point. We don't trust prisoners of war. Our American prisoners of war who confess, right? Because we know that they've probably been tortured, and they'll say anything.
That's
and probably so to save their lives, maybe.
The United States Supreme Court has said that a defendant's confession is the most probative and damaging evidence there is. It emanates from his own mouth. The jury is likely to give it undue weight.
Right.
So that's the point, too, is that even if the defendant were to give up his absolute right not to testify and testify in order to try and put the circumstances surrounding the giving of the statement before the jury, the problem is the jury is still likely to believe the coerced confession.
Well, here you had a one-on-one crime, right? Or at least for one of the elements, one of the charges, right? There was only one person who could testify, right? The woman.
Right.
Right? So she's the only eyewitness, right?
To the offenses.
To the offense. So wouldn't her testimony be very damaging and very important to the jury?
Damaging and what? I'm sorry. I didn't hear your second.
Well, the point is her testimony would have a great deal of weight, wouldn't it? Because it's one word against another.
It is, but in this case, there was also corroborating evidence, which tends to show the reliability of her statement that the defendant now claims was coerced. And because we can compel her to testify, the witness can be compelled to testify, the defendant has additional safeguards that wouldn't be true when it's his own statement. The defendant can compel this witness to testify, can subject her or whatever witness to cross-examination. The defendant could call additional witnesses who were part of the alleged coerced actions, the police, here the social services people, whoever might be involved.
Also, I find it interesting, and I notice you haven't mentioned it, but in this case, particularly, the counsel for the defendant was in that room. And,
right.
And I found that, I don't know if the person was ever called, but certainly I think of a statement coerced, whether it's extreme pressure used, the duty of the lawyer at that time was to represent their client.
And
the defendant, and he or she, the attorney was there at the time this was elicited, which I find makes this a rather unusual case because most of the time you wouldn't have that. Most of the time, and to even insinuate that there was, a, quote, torture or excessive pressure just belies the question that here you have a lawyer there at the time in the room.
A point of clarification that I'm sure Mr. Hennick would appreciate me pointing out, too, is that at the intake conference, her attorney was present. But when she then later gave the statement that was incriminating to the defendant, her attorney was not there for whatever reason.
So he was not there for the questioning that we're...
For the questioning, but at the intake conference, which is where it is alleged that these threats were made against her, we need your cooperation
to
give the statement. He was there at that point, but when she actually gave the statement day or two later, he was not.
I mean, so at the time, he was there when this coercive conduct supposedly took place.
Right, and I think an important point here is that there were these separate ongoing Chapter 48 proceedings related to the placement of Tisha's baby. And in that context, because she was represented by counsel, if she and her attorney felt there were inappropriate or illegal questions or things that should not be considered in the placement of her baby, if she had real concerns about what was going on in that intake conference or afterwards prior to when she gave a statement, she could have sought a remedy with the juvenile court and, you know, made her concerns known to the juvenile court saying, look, they're threatening this, that, or the other thing, and I don't think that's appropriate for them to be considering these things in the placement of my baby and make those concerns known to the juvenile court. It seems inappropriate to me to now, in the defendant's criminal prosecution, to question what went on in these Chapter 48 proceedings when the remedy for anything related to that and what went on and whether it was coercive or improper should have been handled through the Chapter 48.
Do you think it's coercive to tell the woman cooperate and we'll consider your cooperation in determining what to do with your child?
In the context of this kind of case, yes, where they are concerned about the placement of this baby. The mother, this teenage mother, has been on the run for 13 months. They don't know where she's been, who she's been with. Is she going to run away again? What kind of relationship does she still have with the defendant? She was viewed as a victim, and they didn't think they could trust her. She refused to answer any questions that were related to the defendant and her relationship with them. And in the context of the Chapter 48 proceeding, the social services people needed that information to know that they could trust her. And so in the context, when there's a separate ongoing procedure, a legitimate procedure, for which information is needed and these types of questions are necessary and appropriate, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying we need your cooperation, because that was information that they legitimately needed, and she wasn't forthcoming with information that was necessary. So it was appropriate for them to remove the baby pending her cooperation because it was related to the Chapter 48 proceedings.
I take it your point is that it may not be coercive for purposes of Chapter 48. We want to know if we can trust you, and one indication of whether or not we can trust you is your level and nature of your commitment still to the defendant.
Right.
So it may not be coercive for purposes of Chapter 48, but when analyzed in terms of criminal procedure and whether or not it's voluntary, seems to me that it requires and can have a different analysis.
Exactly, and that's the state's point, because the defendant is seeking an extraordinary remedy of suppressing someone else's statement. He didn't give this statement. He is trying to suppress what is relevant evidence, and evidence that the reliability of which can be tested by the jury. The circumstances surrounding the statement can be put before the jury. The defendant has full panoply of options to him to try and let the jury know, look, her statement was coerced. You shouldn't believe her statement. The defendant can call additional witnesses who were part of the proceeding to show the circumstances under which the statement was given and try and argue to the jury, look how coercive this was. She was told this, she was told this, she was told this. Her baby was removed. This is, you know, awful police conduct. You cannot believe her statement. Her statement wasn't given under oath. You should really believe her trial testimony because that's more reliable. The defendant can make all of those arguments. We're not saying that the defendant can't argue those things or cross-examine the witness or bring all those circumstances before the jury. What we are saying is we trust juries to make those decisions. It shouldn't go to the coercion when it's a witness's statement. It shouldn't go to admissibility. It should really go to weight, and that's something that we trust juries to decide. Suppression is too harsh of a remedy under these circumstances. And
what happened here?
Sorry?
What happened in this case?
Not sure what you mean exactly.
Well, what I mean that she testified, right? Go ahead. And then she said that she had been, they gave her her prior statement to impeach her, right?
Right. She got up on the stand at trial and testified inconsistent with her prior statements in which she had incriminated the defendant. And the statement we're talking about is her establishing that she and the defendant had had a sexual relationship in Winnebago County before they left the town to establish jurisdiction.
What did Mr. Samuel do?
I'm sorry?
What did Mr. Samuel do?
At that point, well, there had been a suppression motion hearing prior to trial.
And it was denied.
And it was denied.
Because he had no standing.
Right. And the trial court denied it on grounds of lack of standing.
Right.
Saying, I don't see any cases out there that have ever said a defendant can claim a due process violation on the basis of someone else's allegedly coerced statement. So the trial court said, I'm going to let it in. I said the same thing. It goes to the jury. It's for the jury to consider. It doesn't go to admissibility. And so what happened...
Can I argue to the fact finder?
He did, in fact. The state used her prior statements to impeach her, and in fact sort of preempted the defense attorneys. The prosecutor realized the defense attorney is going to put all these circumstances surrounding the giving of the statement before the jury, and so the prosecutor preempted some of that and asked some of the very questions that he knew the defense attorney would be asking about when the statement was given and the circumstances. So she was called by the prosecution first, this witness, but then later was recalled as a witness by the defense. And then at that point is when the defense attorney asked her all the questions about the circumstances surrounding the statement and additionally called her father and her father's girlfriend, who were at least there for part of the intake proceedings and were aware of the circumstances. And one of the social services investigators was also called to testify, as well as the police officer. And so the full circumstances of the giving of the statement were put before the jury, and then the defense attorney used that to try and argue, you can't believe her testimony here, or you should believe her testimony here today. It's given under oath. You shouldn't believe her prior statements. They're not believable. They were basically coerced.
If we should agree with the Court of Appeals, do you think we have to remand this to the trial court? They did have an evidentiary hearing. The judge just didn't make findings as to coercion, right?
Right. I think that if this court would agree with the Court of Appeals that the CLAPS type standard applies to determining whether a witness's statement should be suppressed on due process grounds, a defendant's due process violation, that it would need to be remanded for an evidentiary hearing. And as the Court of Appeals explained it in its decision, yes, there was already an evidentiary hearing. However, that same judge is no longer on the bench, and the trial court made no factual findings or credibility determinations, so it would be really difficult for a different judge to just looking at the cold record to try and figure out whether there was coercion here. And because the trial court, there was a suppression motion hearing, but since the trial court resolved it really on saying there's no standing, there wasn't really the balancing that's involved in the CLAPS test on, balancing her, the witness's characteristics against the alleged police coercion.
If we could move on at this point.
Were you finished with your answer?
You need me to speak up. I'm going to speak up. I have a threshold legal question.
Sure.
Is a finding of voluntariness a prerequisite to the admissibility of a witness statement, either under the rules of evidence or the Constitution?
Generally, of a witness statement, is there
a finding of voluntariness? Does it matter whether or not the witness's statement is voluntary before it's admitted, either for purposes of rules of evidence, because this came in as a prior inconsistent,
right,
under 904, whatever, and...
I think the defendant has to challenge it. I don't think independently there has to be some showing. If the defendant challenges that a witness's statement is voluntary, I'm not aware of anything that would say
that. What's all the fuss about then? If there isn't any prerequisite to the admissibility of a witness's statement that it be voluntary, we simply allow it to be tested as every other piece of evidence in a criminal trial, or a civil trial for that matter, is tested and let the jury decide
whether
it's
credible. Right, the initial
showing
is relevance, of course, and so if there's some showing that it's relevant evidence, exactly, it should be admitted. The jury can test that and figure out what to do with it. We trust juries to do that all the time.
As a practical matter, don't we often have involuntary witness statements?
Yes.
That were obtained under pressure from the police or because a witness has been subpoenaed and
exactly.
Has failed to come to court, and we issue a body attachment and the witness is thrown in jail until they testify, and then they come to court and testify, and that is, in a factual sense, an involuntary
statement of a witness. Exactly. Witnesses are compelled to testify all the time, even though they don't want to.
Well.
And there may have been some circumstances that seem coercive in all of that, too, but under normal circumstances, we don't question that. We let it come in, and the jury hears about it and decides what to do with it.
Well, can we clarify, then, what the state's position is? Are you saying that there has to be a suppression hearing only in the situation where there's extreme coercion, where there's extreme coercion or torture, or what specifically are you proposing?
What the state is proposing is that the way it would proceed is the defendant would presumably file a suppression motion, and the state is proposing that there needs to be an initial pleading burden, sort of like the Bentley-Nelson type standard, that, and based on the state's proposed test, in this pleading, the defendant would need to plead circumstances or factors that show shocking police misconduct, in addition to showing factors of unreliability. And if the defendant can plead those adequately, but only if, and only if he can plead both of those things, should there be a hearing. Short of that, if the defendant has conclusory allegations, or, you know, the normal Bentley standards, or here, if the defendant can't plead anything that shows shocking police misconduct, or can't show anything that would suggest unreliability of the statement, other than saying she was coerced, this statement is unreliable, that would not be enough to get a hearing. And that's one of the main reasons why the state thinks this case is very important, because
what happens after the hearing? So if there's no hearing, that's the end of it. Then there's a hearing, and there's a showing of shocking police misconduct and factors showing unreliability. Then what happens?
If the pleading requirement is met and there's a hearing,
Who is the burden of proof?
The state believes that because we're in a different ballgame than a coerced confession, and this evidence would normally come in, that the burden should be on the defendant.
Okay. All right. Now, the defendant has met its burden. Then what happens? What does the trial judge do?
If the defendant meets the burden of showing that their shocking police conduct
Absolutely.
And unreliability is
right.
suppressed, the statement doesn't get to come
Okay,
in.
So your answer to Justice Sykes was there's no, if I understood your answer, that there's no constitutional ground or other basis for suppressing. Now you want it suppressed, is that right? What is your basis for saying it should be suppressed?
Well, the defendant's basis is...
No, I want your basis, because this is what the state wants.
The state doesn't want it to
not
be
in this
suppressed.
Case. Not in this case, but
well,
your theory is that if the defendant proves all that, yeah.
Right.
So what's your basis for saying it should be suppressed? What's your legal basis?
Due process violation.
Okay, so it's your state's position that there's a 14th Amendment due process violation if there's been shocking police misconduct and factors showing untrustworthiness of a witness's statement.
Right, but...
And then to use that statement would violate due process.
Right. But only if there's absolutely no reliability that can be shown. Because if there's some reliability...
Do you have a case that says what you want?
Unfortunately, no. There's no court that has looked at this situation exactly, this exact situation.
What about the 10th Circuit Clanton and Gonzalez?
Right. The 10th Circuit, which is what the Court of Appeals relied on here, basically said that we treat it the same way we do a coerced confession. We use the same test.
The underpinning of that is in terms of due process. But didn't the 10th Circuit say, okay, look, coercive statements are inherently unreliable, and it is a violation of due process to be convicted or confronted with inherently unreliable statements?
Right.
Do you agree with that analysis?
I do not, because I think the problem with the 10th Circuit's analysis is the court fails to consider the differences between coerced confessions and witness statements in the sense that not all coerced statements are unreliable, and when it's a witness's statement, we can test the reliability of the statement, or the jury can, by bringing in the circumstances surrounding the giving of the statement. So to say that it's inherently unreliable, so it can't ever come in, makes sense when it's a coerced confession, because we need those adequate protections for a defendant because of the additional Fifth Amendment concerns. But when it's a witness's statement, I don't think there's inherent unreliability. The state can oftentimes, and in this case, for example, show that there are indicia of reliability for the statement, and so the statement ought to come in.
Could I ask you a fruit of the poisonous tree question? Suppose there has been coercion, even serious coercion. May the statement be followed up to gather evidence that would make it reliable?
I'm not sure I understand your question. May the statement be followed up by whom?
Well, I think the chief asked earlier whether the witness statement and the defendant's statement should be treated exactly the same, and you said that they should not.
Right.
If they were treated exactly the same, it would seem to me you could not go and use the fruit of the poisonous tree, the evidence that you get as a result of the confession. I'm asking you now, can you take the statement from the witness and then go out and find evidence to corroborate that statement?
I think, if you're under the state's test, certainly you can. If we're looking at it exactly the same way we do a coerced confession, reliability arguably is less a consideration under that standard. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
Well, suppose there was torture, right? And it had to be suppressed under your standard. Now, in torturing the person said something and said, oh, and John Smith was also a witness, or John Smith knows the facts. Now, you'd suppress this witness's statement because it's under torture. Can you go find John Smith now? That's the fruit of the poisonous tree. I think that's Justice Prosser's, as I understand Justice Prosser's question, that's what it is. So, can you do that? Torture. Shocking police misconduct. Untrustworthy.
You know, it's not something I thought about enough to come up with a clear answer, but I do know that there are cases that talk about fruit of the poisonous tree also being inadmissible.
For a witness. On due process grounds,
yes.
Court doesn't want to be in this business.
Right.
Is that I don't know.
I think that's the rationale, is that I know there are cases, for example, a witness gave a statement that was arguably coerced, or that's the argument, that it was coerced, but then that witness testifies, gives a statement, then testifies at trial. There are cases that I believe talk about if there's a showing that the trial testimony is reliable and the witness is not still under the coercion, that's not the fruit of the poisonous tree of the prior arguably coerced statement.
Counsel, what about, I was looking at your opposing counsel's brief on pages 33 and 34 about the Velez case, which is a Wisconsin 1999 case, and using that standard or that approach as far as determining these very questions we're talking about.
I'm not sure I understand your question. Are you asking whether the Velez standard is the appropriate standard?
Well, yes.
Right. Yeah, that's actually the standard that the state offered for determining whether a hearing is appropriate. So the parties are in agreement about that. We're in disagreement over who has the burden of proof.
Before you sit down, would you flip around and address the opposite side of the question? What about a coerced defense witness statement as opposed to a coerced state's witness statement?
I'm not sure that the analysis would necessarily be different. If there's a coerced defense
Well, I mean, what we're talking about essentially is unreliability as a matter of law. I mean, that's the ultimate, to go back to the Chief's question a few moments ago, what is the ultimate question being decided at this hearing?
Right.
And if suppression is the remedy, then we're talking about unreliability as a matter of law because of the coercion.
Right.
And it's so bad it needs to be suppressed, so that's a finding as a matter of law, rather than, you know, maybe it was factually coerced, or we're going to let the jury sort it out as to whether it was reliable. We're having the judge make a finding as a matter of law that this was legally unreliable, and therefore a due process violation, and therefore suppressible. I mean, I can think of all kinds of circumstances under which defense witnesses are beaten and tortured and coerced into making statements and then being subpoenaed to come to court.
Exactly.
And if the police find out about the circumstances under which the defense testimony is being given, typically there's not a suppression motion.
Right, right. Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at things as far as who could do something about that if it's a defense statement that's arguably coerced. You know, that if it's obviously the defendant would have an interest in trying to seek to suppress that if the coerced defense witness is giving, but I don't know why it would be a defense witness then. If
they just wouldn't have a due process violation because the state doesn't have a due process right to a jury trial.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Sorry.
I answered my
question. I'm a little confused. Thank you.
Mr. Hennick, representing Mr. Samuel.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Robert Hennick. I represent Stanley Samuel on this appeal. I believe, Justice Sykes, the most direct answer to your last question is that the reason why coerced involuntary statements must be suppressed on grounds of due process is because it is the state which has done the coercion. Excuse me, coercing isn't a word. When an individual, for instance, if an individual coerces another person to testify in favor of the state, that would not be suppressed because there is no state coercion. There always has to be a state actor. Under Colorado v. Connolly and under CLAPS, there has to be state coercion in order for it to be involuntary and therefore suppressed.
So it has nothing to do with the alleged inherent unreliability of a coerced statement. It has everything to do with the police misconduct and the state misconduct?
No, it has to do with the combination of police misconduct or coercion and the resulting unreliability. Under Jackson v. Detto and also like Spano v. New York, the U.S. Supreme Court clarified that the reason why we suppress statements on the grounds of due process is not just because they're inherently unreliable, and I disagree with counsel that any coerced statement can be deemed reliable. The Supreme Court said they're inherently unreliable, but it's not just on that ground. It's also because we as a society have decided that the state, with all of its power, should not be allowed to essentially break the law or break a person to create evidence.
Well, what I'm getting at is that it's not primarily the alleged unreliability of a coerced statement that results in these rules. It's the, in the case of the Fifth Amendment, the constitutional protections that are there to prevent this sort of state action, right?
Yes.
In the case of a due process argument, it seems to me, you know, that alleged unreliability is being moved to a position of primacy in the analysis that it has never had before.
It has always had that position. Starting with the Brown v. Alabama, it was the combination of the state misconduct and the inherent unreliability of a tortured statement that resulted in a due process violation in that case. And recall, at the time of Brown, the Fifth Amendment didn't apply to states. So it was only the due process clause. And when we're talking about the difference between self-incrimination violations and due process violations, the court has actually developed separate complex of values. The state refers to one group of values that directly applies to the Fifth Amendment self-incrimination clause. But the U.S. Supreme Court has developed a separate, although related, complex of values that justify suppression of coerced statements, coerced involuntary statements, on the grounds of due process. Those always cite to the inherent unreliability of a coerced statement. Number two, the idea that as a society, we cannot accept the kind of conduct that leads to them. And there is a third one, but unfortunately, I can't come up with it right now. But it is those two factors joining together that cause the due process violation. And the state has made much of this chart. I submit to the court that there is absolutely no legal basis for either of the requirements in that chart. No case that I know of, no case that the state cites, has ever required that a statement be the result of conduct which is shocking to the conscience in order to be a due process violation. In fact, that language, shocking to the conscience, comes from the Rochin decision, in which the court actually equated the misconduct involved in that case with the type of coercion that is involved in violation of a due process rights, and would result in suppression of a coerced statement. So if anything, under Rochin, the shocking the conscience incorporates the same ban on coercing statements that we're talking about. Now, they're kind of trying to get back to the beginning. The state raises three main issues here. First is what standard to apply when a defendant claims that a witness's statement has been coerced by police conduct and is therefore involuntary. The second is whether on the facts of this case, taking a woman's newborn child until that woman agrees to provide a statement incriminating the father meets that standard. And the third is whether it's harmless. The state is correct that there is a fourth issue that's raised, but is not directly on point with the facts of this case, regarding what kind of an allegation the defendant has to make in order to get a hearing, to be entitled to a hearing on this issue, on this due process issue. We agree with the state that the Velez standard should apply.
That's a Benchley plus statement. Is that a Benchley plus standard?
Or
Nelson plus standard?
It's a Nelson plus standard. It's a taking into account the specific fact that these kind of emotions are going to be made before trial. The defendant is going to have a limited amount of information, and therefore we cannot require, as in Nelson, that the defendant allege facts which establish his entitlement to relief. Rather, the court only requires allegations of fact from which there's a reasonable possibility of success. So we agree with the state that the Velez standard should apply. We disagree with the state on who has the burden, since what we are talking about is whether the results of police misconduct or police coercion should be admitted at trial. The standard, I think, definitely has to be that the state has to prove that there was no coercion and that the evidence should be admitted.
What was the police misconduct here?
In this particular case, just to summarize the evidence, and I think the evidence is pretty much undisputed. At the intake conference, to address the issue of where Cheyenne, the child, was going to be, whether she was going to be with her mother or in a foster home, the social workers were there. A sexual abuse investigator, Mr. Schroffnagel, was there. A police officer, Mr. Sagmeister, was there. And they were all asking questions, focusing on both where they were when they were out of state, but also the sexual relationship before they left and while they were gone.
Does the record show that the police officer was asking questions?
I believe the record shows that they were all asking questions. They were all upset with her lack of, quote, cooperation.
Who's all?
Let me ask this. What right did she have not to cooperate?
If the questions did actually relate to placement of the child, such as we can agree where she was out of state. That is a there is possibly a rational basis for that. The question of whether she had sex with Stan Samuel 18 months earlier in Wisconsin, I can see no possible rational connection between that and whether she would take care of her baby, or whether she could be trusted to take care of her baby. But it is
What was her right not to answer that question in a police investigation? You sort of characterized it as a police investigation.
Yes, and with regard to that question, it most certainly was.
Is she claiming a Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination some way?
No, she has the right that every citizen in this country has when a police officer comes up to ask a question to just say, no, I don't want to talk to you.
This was during an intake hearing, as I mentioned to opposing counsel, when her lawyer was there. They were all there, including her lawyer.
Yes, her lawyer was there, and he did not do a single thing to stop the coercion. She was left with the understanding that the state refers to, well, she should have gone through the court to get her baby back. Well, the option that she was given at that point, the child was gone. They had already taken the child. The only way she's going to get the child back at that point, to her knowledge, is by giving a statement that says we had sex in Wisconsin before we left.
Did she give the statement then?
She gave the statement the next day.
But not then. They left.
Right.
Without a statement.
Right.
So what happens then? She comes back to whom?
What happens after that is the Schroffnagel, the sex abuse investigator, contacts her father, tells her the cooperation we're looking for is an account of a sexual relationship in Wisconsin before the time you leave. Peter, like her father, relates that to Tisha because that's what he was told to do. At that point, she goes in and she gives a statement.
She voluntarily goes in where?
She did not voluntarily go in. She went in because...
She goes in under this implied threat. Okay, where does she go? Physically. She's going to the police station. She's going to court. She's going to...
Courthouses.
To social services.
They can't remember. It was in one of the courthouses.
I know, but is it in an open court proceeding? Is it before the judge? The courthouse has a lot of offices.
The only people that were there were her father, Peter, was there very shortly and then left. And then it was Schroffnagel, who was the sexual abuse investigator, and Sagmeister, who was the police officer and teacher.
So she voluntarily, in effect, goes back to law enforcement officers. Why shouldn't say voluntary? She goes back under this message. Okay, and what does she say? Does she call her lawyer?
No. The lawyer testified that he did not know about this until long afterwards.
Did the lawyer tell her that that's what they probably do? If she didn't cooperate, they probably would take away the baby?
There was no testimony at the hearing regarding what he advised her. The only testimony was from, on that point, was his understanding that that was exactly what they were looking for.
Mr. Hennig, would you tell me how the trial judge and the way he handled this violated due process rights? I understand what the state has conceded here, the state's position, but as I understand the federal case law, there's a real division in the circuits. For instance, I looked at the Seventh Circuit case of Johnson versus Washington, where the trial judge handled the matter of an alleged coerced witness statement in very much the same way as the trial judge did here. And this is a 1997 decision where the Seventh Circuit said, no problem, that's okay. Tell me how there's a violation of due process with what Judge Williams did in this case.
There are actually two points there. One, Johnson v. Washington is the only case that actually supports the state. Johnson v. Washington In that case, the Seventh Circuit overlooked two prior Seventh Circuit decisions. One is Buckley versus Fitzsimmons that holds that admission of a coerced witness statement at the defendant's trial violates his right to due process. Actually, it was not a holding, but it was a statement by the Seventh Circuit. Another, I can't remember the name, I think it was Caiavello or something like that, which also reached the same conclusion. In Johnson v. Washington, the court did not apply the analysis of those cases or of Mert or Bradley v. Johnson or of any of the cases that have actually addressed on due process grounds admission of a coerced witness statement. Rather, the court looks simply at the rule of evidence and apparently overlooked all of these cases. They do not mention it. It does mention the fact that the defendant did not even cite a case that would support his position. So my reading of that is that the court in Johnson did not have all of these other cases contrary to his position at the time that he rendered the decision. It didn't discuss them, it didn't rebut them. It just decided, well, we don't see any legal basis for this, so we're not going to hold in favor of the defendant. Now, in this particular case, what the state court did, or the trial court did, is he held the hearing. I believe that the facts, undisputed facts, demonstrate beyond doubt that this was coercion, that at least under the CLAPS test, this was coercion, and Tisha did not have the ability to overcome that, did not have the personal characteristics to respond to that and overcome it.
Well, didn't he leave it to the jury to determine whether or not the statement or which of the statements of the witness were reliable and should be accepted?
Yes, he did, and that was a mistake.
Why do you think it's a mistake?
For the same reason that the a defendant's coerced statements cannot be just submitted to the jury and let them sort it out. In Jackson v. Deno, the Supreme Court cited both, again, the unreliability, the inherent unreliability of a coerced statement, and also the fact that the state should not be allowed to benefit from its coercive actions or its misconduct. To simply throw this to the jury and let the jury decide, lets the jury take into account things that are not relevant to the issue of due process. Things like whether, even though inherently unreliable, the statement may be in fact reliable. In Jackson v. Deno, for instance, the court said the jury, in assessing these things, wouldn't just look to whether it was coerced and whether the individual would be able to respond to the coercion or fight off the coercion. But they also would look to see, well, it doesn't really matter because it's truthful anyway.
Well, in Jackson v. Deno, isn't the court also looking at the Fifth Amendment rights, the privilege against self-incrimination? Isn't that a very basic part of the reasoning behind Jackson versus Deno?
Can't remember if they included that as well as the process. I know that that could be, in some circumstances, a difference, but there is, I submit, no rational difference between the two rights when it comes to, do we just take unreliable evidence and throw it to the jury and let them sort it out when it's been coerced by the state? Should we allow the state, through its misconduct, its coercion, taint the jury determinations? And that's what we're talking about here, because the state agrees that there are some circumstances in which due process requires suppression. The question is whether in this other group of cases where there is a coerced statement, statements that are involuntary under the traditional due process standard, in other words, that they have been created by state conditions, whether the state should be able to benefit from those. That's what we're talking about here.
Well, this statement came in as an impeachment, though, didn't it? Tisha's allegedly coerced statement. I mean, she's on the witness stand. She's giving what the state believes is false testimony about never having sex with your client in Wisconsin while she was 15 during the time period in question. And
I mean, if we're talking about the fairness of the trial,
yeah,
and the truth-seeking function of the jury, isn't it fair to allow the state to attempt to impeach her with her prior inconsistent statement and then let the facts of how that statement was obtained go before the jury in all their completeness and let the jury decide whether her later statement in court was true or whether her earlier statement under pressure about the baby was true? What's unfair about that?
It was used for impeachment, but under Wisconsin law, it also was substantive evidence. Prior inconsistent statements are also admitted as substantive evidence. A number of cases cited by the state make that distinction, saying that we can allow this in because it's only impeachment. There's no due process violation because it's only impeachment. But in this case, the reason why it is not fair and why it is directly contrary to the underpinnings of due process is because it is not enhancing the truth-finding function of the jury. When you take evidence which is inherently unreliable, as the Supreme Court has said, such statements are coerced, involuntary statements are inherently unreliable. To then put them into the mix, you are debasing or interfering with the truth-finding function of the jury. You are not enhancing it. A similar situation is the case in which there is the police, through unnecessarily suggestive procedures, create an identification by a witness. The core reason why those are suppressed is because they are unreliable. Same kind of thing. We don't let that come in on cross-examination just because it's cross-examination. The truth-finding function is interfered with and undermined when we allow one party to coerce statements and then use them to their own benefit. On the issue of whether, in fact, this was a coerced and involuntary statement, I would direct the court's attention or ask the court to consider Lynham, Tingle, Raphael, the Alaska's Supreme Court decision. The very idea that, and you know, I can say as a parent, someone taking a child away has to be one of the most coercive acts that I can imagine. No matter what standard we're going to apply, taking my child away, you may pull my fingernails out, but I would quicker tell a lie to get my child back than I would to stop the fingernails.
What should the police have done here? How should they have obtained evidence from Tish?
What the police and what the social workers should have done in this case is limited to questions to information which is, in fact, relevant to the purpose of the intake conference, which was to determine where the child should be placed or who should have actual custody of the child. They should not have used that as a way to expand a police investigation. They should not have distorted the purpose of the intake conference to turn it into a police investigation.
Well, what should they have done?
How
should they have obtained the information?
They should have, with her attorney present, if she so desired, asked her, without threats, whether there was any kind of sexual relationship before she left. If she turned around and said, "I'm not going to talk to you," then they can't do anything else other than subpoena her to testify, perhaps at a John Doe proceeding, something like that.
Well, didn't she? Maybe I'm confused, counsel. Which isn't unusual, but she was talking about what happened during the intake meeting. She was told countless times to cooperate.
Yes.
And her counsel. Now, her counsel was there, and this was the Chapter 48 hearing. That's what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you suggesting then? I'm talking about your response to Justice Prosser's question. This is where she said the coercion took place.
Yes.
During the intake conference, and that's what the point I was making. She had counsel there, as well as it was on the record. I'm just saying that.
It was not on the record.
Well, okay, but her counsel was with her.
Yes. Our counsel did
but
nothing.
But some of the, obviously, some of the intake hearing, I assume, was on the record. I'm not sure, but about that fact. But I am that her attorney was there at the time she says she was told to cooperate, and that they were asking her questions about what she had done during the past year. And she stated she did not answer the questions because she did not think they were relevant to the placement of her daughter.
Yes. And the those over the past year where she was, that I believe was relevant to the placement of her daughter. What was not relevant is expanding beyond that to the question of did you have sex 18 months earlier in Wisconsin, which was a purely police investigatory question.
Did they do a paternity test on this child?
I don't know, but I know that Mr. Samuel has never denied that he is a parent.
So the assumption here is that he is the parent. Therefore, there's an assumption that there was sexual relations.
Yes, outside the state of Wisconsin.
Right. Do you think that you can coerce a witness? It's okay to coerce in front of the attorney?
It is not okay to coerce anywhere, anytime.
That's your position?
Yes. I believe that's the position of the
attorney. You don't care if the attorney's there?
No, that is a factor. Having the attorney there is a factor in determining whether the character of the witness, with the support of the attorney, is enough to overcome the coercion.
Okay, so with the witness there, she doesn't answer. With the attorney there, she doesn't answer.
Right. At that point, the child had just been taken away, and no, she did not answer the questions at that point.
When it came down to the baby or making incriminating statements against the man, she chose to let the baby go and not make incriminating statements. Is that the position?
At that point, yeah, she did not make the incriminating statements. It was only afterwards when later that night, Schroffnagel told her father what they were looking for and what she would be required to do to get the baby back. And although it's not in the record, presumably when it's set in that she's going home and her daughter is.
Does the record indicate when the young woman had her 16th birthday?
That would have been September of 96, I believe.
And when did they run away together?
January of 96.
Counsel, let me assume that we get to the issue that's set forth in both counsel's brief, that the court, whether or not the Court of Appeals erred in determining that testimony so tainted the other two convictions that they too must be vacated, I guess. One of the convictions, and the purpose, I'll tell you where I'm going with this inquiry. I'm wondering whether the Court of Appeals was right on that. I'm wondering whether or not the convictions would stand absent any testimony of this young woman. I look at the jury instructions for the, let's say, another charge, interfering with the custody of a child. That was one of the other convictions. First element shows that she's not age 18. Seems to me that that can be shown without her testimony. Second element requires to establish who the parents or custodians are of the child. That can be done without her testimony. The third element requires that the defendant took away the child from the parent or custodian without the parent or custodian's consent. Seems to me that can be shown without any of this young woman's testimony. So couldn't that charge stand regardless of what this court determines, assuming it gets to that question, and Why does it have to be vacated like the Court of Appeals? I don't understand.
Because the standard for harmless error does not look to whether there is sufficient evidence for conviction absent the error, but whether the error, whether the court can say beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to the conviction.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I know the standard. It must be shown beyond a reasonable doubt the jury still would have reached that result. And I'm saying with these three elements, these three elements are even beyond any need for her to testify. So maybe I can say it beyond a reasonable doubt. That's where I'm headed at.
But the fact is that Tisha testified at trial that she was thrown out, that her mother threw her out of the house, so that under any circumstance, if she was thrown out, then she's not taken from the custody of the parent.
Well,
the parent has already given up the custody.
Well, I guess perhaps that's maybe, we're not talking about just the house, we're just talking about, we can also be talking about custody. It's broader than took her out of the house.
Except I believe the jury, I'm not certain about this, but I believe the jury instructions referred to the house.
I don't know what the instructions in this case.
Yeah, I don't.
But custody is a much broader thing. I mean, taking a child to a different state without the parent's consent can certainly be interference with custody. Yes?
It can be under a separate provision. The problem is, in this case, the defendant was charged, and the jury instruction specifically referred to the taking away. There can also be causing to leave. There can also be keeping her away from the parents. I think
and
once you
was charged with one and was submitted in the instruction of the other.
But I think the couple of problems here. One, on the abduction charge, a necessary element is taking for an illegal purpose, the illegal purpose in this case being sex. So I think that the statements regarding prior sexual conduct goes directly
in
to that.
In response to the chief's question, you acknowledged, you said that the defendant in no way contested paternity. I guess
right.
That'd be okay to say acknowledged paternity, which indicates to me sex, which indicates to me sex with someone under the age of 18, which indicates to me illegal activity.
Yes.
No need of testimony at all. Just say, here's a baby. He's the father.
Yes, that was going 9 months back from March of 1997. That would have been 6 months after they left Wisconsin. So it would not have been in any circumstance sex in Wisconsin. And the idea of sex 6 months after leaving, I don't believe is establishes that the leaving in the first place was for the purposes of sex. Tisha testified at trial that it was not until 2 or 3 months later, after they had been together, that they first had sex somewhere out of the state.
I submit there might be a reasonable inference, but maybe not.
Yes, and I admit there may be a reasonable inference. We aren't talking, though, about sufficiency of the evidence. We're talking about whether this jury necessarily would have convicted but for the error. And I submit that there is a very good jury argument, but that's not enough for harmless error analysis. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hennick. Ms. Herman?
Ms. Herman, before you begin, I have a question with respect to the procedure that you are advocating here.
Sure.
On page 12 of your brief, that's the red brief, the paragraph, second full paragraph that starts when the defendant seeks suppression.
Yes, I see what you're talking about.
Yeah, you say the witness can be compelled to testify and the alleged coercion can be drawn out by cross-examination, giving the jury the opportunity to hear the circumstances. And then in the next paragraph, you say, moreover, a defendant should be required to meet a threshold showing of coercion before he or she is entitled to an evidentiary hearing.
Right.
I guess maybe I'm just, I don't quite understand what it is you're saying. Are you saying that there should be an evidentiary hearing or that the jury should decide these issues of extreme coercion or voluntariness?
I'm saying there should only be an evidentiary hearing if the defendant makes a showing of extreme coercion. In the absence of that, if he just alleges something less than what I'm saying extreme coercion includes, those two components, shocking police misconduct as well as no indicia of reliability, if he can show those two things, then he gets an evidentiary hearing.
Okay, and that's an evidentiary hearing before the judge? Who's the fact finder? Because in that paragraph that I just read, you sound like it's the jury that should be given the opportunity to hear the circumstances.
The jury should be entitled to hear. The jury is the finder of fact in the absence, two things. In the absence of a showing of extreme coercion or torture, the statement comes in and the jury should hear about it. Fine, the jury can hear the circumstances surrounding the statement. Even if there is a show, well, I guess that's my point.
Counsel, this is a summary of your argument.
This here, right. This part of my brief is a summary of my argument.
And that paragraph goes with the preceding paragraph, doesn't it?
I think so.
Well, I don't understand. Excuse me, but I don't understand what you're saying here. Is this going to be an evidentiary hearing, or if the defendant makes a showing, then it goes in front of a jury? Which one? Is it a jury issue, or is it an issue for the judge?
It's both on some level. Initially, it's a question for the judge to determine whether it goes before the jury.
Okay, what if the judge decides that it should not go, that it was coercive?
Then it's suppressed and doesn't come in.
So then it doesn't go to the jury?
Right.
So when does it go to the jury?
It goes to the jury if the defendant can make a showing that the statement was the product of extreme coercion. It goes to the jury when the defendant cannot show extreme coercion or torture. He doesn't make that showing. If he makes that showing, it's suppressed. If he doesn't make that showing, it comes in, and then the jury decides what weight to give it, and the jury can still hear the circumstances surrounding the giving of the statement. If there's extreme coercion or torture under the state's standard, it's suppressed. Short of that, it comes in.
Thank you.
Sure.
And then one last question.
Sure.
It seems to me that an argument can be made forcefully that the threat to take away a mother's child is extreme coercion. And so that if that is a finding that there was this threat to take away, that's extreme coercion. How do you respond to that?
I respond to that in a couple of ways. One is in the context of this case, under some circumstances perhaps, like the Linham case and the Tingle case, where there were not separate ongoing Chapter 48 proceedings, so there weren't separately legitimate reasons for removal of the child. In Linham and Tingle, it was they're both cases involving the defendant, and they were seeking confessions from the defendant, and they were threatening to remove the defendant's child if she didn't confess. That's an entirely different situation than we have here, and that might be the case in other cases where there are legitimate separate Chapter 48 proceedings going on, in which the need to protect the baby is of paramount importance there. And so any perceived threat to take away the baby is in the context of that Chapter 48 proceeding. And there's a legitimate basis for the coercion, which is part of the test that the state has offered, that two of the factors, to support a finding of shocking police conduct are lack of good faith basis other than to elicit the statement or the questioning or tactics, or the threat of illegal consequence for failing to provide a statement. Neither of those are met here because there is a good faith basis other than trying to get an incriminating statement against the defendant for the questioning in this case. They are trying to determine the placement of this baby, and they have real concerns because she's not giving them information that they need to determine whether they can trust a girl who's been on the run for 13 months with her baby. And as far as the threat of illegal consequence, Here there was no threat of an illegal consequence. It was legal for the authorities to remove this baby if they felt that the baby's safety was in jeopardy. So it cannot be shocking police conduct if it's lawful police conduct, as in this case, under Chapter 48 proceedings. And moreover, I would like to just briefly, I see my time is up.
Yeah, just conclude briefly. So.
I just would like to briefly encourage the court to look closely at the facts of this case, because I think the facts are not as Mr. Hennick has portrayed them. Tisha was never told what to say. She was never told she had to give an incriminating statement against the defendant. She was asked open-ended questions. What happened? Where were you? When did it happen? Who did you have sex with? When did that occur? She was never explicitly or really, she was not told, you need to give an incriminating statement against the defendant or you will not get your baby back. She was not told specifically what she had to say.
Was her father told that?
She claims her father was told that, but her father doesn't even claim that he was told that.
Okay.
So I think there's some spin on the facts based on her perceptions and, in fact, perhaps her father's perceptions as well.
Do you think there was no coercion? That's your really basic argument.
There was no coercion under any standard. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Herman. Thank you, Mr. Hennick. That-